Item 53, accept report from Portland Public School District on disproportionate discipline.
Thank you. Well, let me call up our honored guests here to make this presentation and with just a brief explanation, why should the Portland City Council have a public hearing on disproportionate discipline in the public schools and a strategy to deal with it? And I would have three answers to that question. One, the city charter actually has a wonderful provision in it that says that the mayor and council should exercise a general supervision of all the affairs of the city, which means we should pay attention to what's happening in the community, even if it's not our direct governmental responsibility. And we do, as a city, do that. And this is one of those instances. Secondly, this city council and our predecessors have really focused on equity. And it's why we have an Office of Equity and Human Rights. It's why we put a lot of attention into equity as a community. And this is an equity issue that we need to pay close attention to. Additionally, this particular issue is one that the school district has a very aggressive plan to address. And I was so impressed by the presentation that I asked them to essentially replicate here for us this morning when Lorenzo made it to our Community Peace Collaborative, formerly known as the Gang Violence Task Force, a couple weeks ago. So I appreciate your willingness, Superintendent and Lorenzo, to come here today and make this presentation. And then finally, by happenstance, some of us were in a conference on Friday called the What Works Conference, and it's a conference about the criminal justice system that the local public safety coordinating committee puts on, and that heard an amazing presentation from Dr. Robert Anda, who was the chief author of the ACEs study, the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study. Commissioner Novick and I were both there, heard this presentation, and an hour of this man's presentation was just enough to whet my appetite, because that study demonstrates to me scientifically and unassailably that there is a ironclad connection between what happens to young people at an early age and the likelihood that they will have difficulties later on, including showing up in our criminal justice system, which men of color do particularly disproportionately. So we're in the public safety business. If we want to get upstream, we ought to think about these issues. And fortunately, we have some school district leadership that are thinking about them and preparing to act decisively. So I wanted to give them the opportunity to put that situation and their strategy before us, and hopefully for us to be an effective ally for their work. So Superintendent Smith, Lorenzo Poe, and anyone else from your team, welcome, and really glad that you could be here this morning. Morning.
Good morning. So Carol Smith, Superintendent, and Mayor Hales and Commission were really pleased to be able to come and do this report and appreciate deeply the partnership with the city in the work that we're doing. As you know, equity has been a primary focus and driver for Portland Public Schools. In 2010, our board passed an equity policy, which has really been our guiding framework. And then this fall, we set three priorities, which are anchored in that framework. The first is we want every single one of our third graders reading at grade level by the time they leave third grade, believing that that changes the experience for them for the whole rest of the time they're in Portland Public Schools, and that our best shot at closing the achievement gap is doing it early. Second was around exclusionary discipline. And our goal, we've set an aggressive target over the next 2 years to cut our exclusionary discipline by 50%. So that's suspensions and expulsions, 50% overall. And then again, 50% the disproportionality of students of color being excluded from school. And then our third goal is to accelerate our graduation and completion rates, both four-year and five-year. Since 2007, we have increased our graduation rate by 14 percentage points, getting us to 67%. It's still not high enough, although that's an incredible increase in that time period. The comparable time period or statistic for the state in that same time period is 2%. So we're looking at accelerating strategies that we know work that graduate kids on time. The only other context I want to provide to you is that We've got a strategic plan that looks at the strategies for all of our students, an equity plan that really targets our students of color and trying to really do very personalized strategies that meet their needs. And now, as of last June, we signed on to a Males of Color pledge with the Council of Great City Schools as part of Barack Obama's My Brother's Keeper. And it's very compatible with the Black Male Success Initiative that the city is doing. And part of what our effort is here, it's with the 67 other large urban school districts in the country. We went and stood with Obama as he rolled out the My Brother's Keeper. And it's really asking all of us to look very personally at what strategies work for our males of color, because the gap there is even more significant. So that's the context I want to provide you. I just want to say the other appreciation for the Black Male Success Initiative or Black Male Achievement Initiative, and also for your partnership on coaching boys to men. We were just at a PIL basketball showcase on Saturday, and took something that you guys are helping us support and take something that's been a successful program at Franklin with our male athletes and taking it system-wide, and you guys are really primary support in helping us provide that training. But those kinds of things that are very specific and personal strategies matter. So thank you for your partnership. With that, Lorenzo Poe.
Let me turn it over to Sarah Singer, because one of the things we want to set the frame by letting you see some of the data points which drives our strategies and also has driven the superintendent to identify, particularly in exclusionary discipline, the reason that becomes such a high strategy level for us. So let me turn it over to Sarah, walk you through some of the data, and I'll come back and talk about some of our key strategic efforts to address the issue.
Great. Thanks, Lorenzo. Again, my name is Sarah Singer, and I'm the senior director of our System Planning and Performance Unit, which, among other things, includes all things related to data at PPS. Before I start presenting on the data, one thing I want to make sure is that we're operating under the same understanding of what exclusionary discipline means. So in this context, when I talk about exclusionary discipline, I'm talking about students who've either been expelled or students who've been suspended. And in most of these slides, it will be students who have experienced an out-of-school suspension, meaning that they have been asked to leave the school building for a finite period of time. So there's many reasons to care about our discipline rates and our disproportionality. One of the most critical reasons is that it directly correlates with our graduation rate. So what we know is that students who've been excluded, who have never been excluded at PPS, have a 68% graduation rate, of a four-year graduation rate. But students who've been excluded at least once, their graduation rate drops to 43%. And students who've been excluded between 2 to 5 times, their graduation rate drops to 34%. And then finally, students who've been excluded between 5 and 10 times, their graduation rate drops to 20%. We've been tracking our exclusionary discipline for a number of years, and if we were to look at sort of where we were as a district in 2007 and 8, approximately 7% of our students experienced at least one exclusion. And last year, 3.3% of our students experienced one exclusion. So we are trending in the right direction over time. However, when we look at our African American or Black population, in 2007, it was about 18% of our students experiencing at least one exclusion. And last year we were at 10.5%. So again, we're making fewer of our African Americans are getting excluded. However, if you look at that green line, when we look at our white population in particular, you'll see that last year 2.3% of our white population experienced an exclusionary incident. You compare that to our Black population at 10.5%. What you're looking at is our Black population experiencing exclusion in comparison to our whites at about 5 times the rate. Nationally, we see it around 2 to 3 times. So there is an issue here in Portland.
Are you tracking other minorities?
Yes. So I just put the Black population, but this next slide, we're looking at other groups as well. We see disparities in other racial ethnic groups. The Native population is our second most excluded group, Our Black population is our first. And so you can see in this slide how disparities break out by racial ethnic groups. One thing I want to comment on this slide is that in this one, I've included in-school suspensions. So in-school suspension, as well as out-of-school suspensions. So in-school suspensions are where a student has an incident, has a violation. They're not sent home, but they're taken away from the classroom and still in the school building. It's just another way to define exclusion. But here's what I'm going to tell you. There's a lot of different ways to measure exclusionary discipline. You can look at days missed. You can look at incidents. You can look at percent of students excluded. You can include in-school suspensions or not. Regardless of how you cut the data, you're going to see our Black population followed by our Native population who experience the greatest percentage or who experience the greatest amount of discipline in our system, regardless of how you cut that data.
And do you track it based on African immigrants versus African Americans?
We did do a study this year on that, and what we saw was our African immigrants have a disproportionate amount of exclusion. They experience a disproportionate amount of incidents in comparison to whites, but our African Americans experience the most. And so we also disaggregate the data by gender and race. And so what we see is our Black male followed by our Native males followed by our Black females experiencing the most amount of exclusion. And there is definitely a gender component here, because you can see after our Black females, it's a host of males of color who then experience the next most. And if you keep going here, you'll see our white females and our Asian females experience the least. What I will also tell you is we've done this type of analysis for 3 straight years, and it's interesting because for 3 straight years, Black males are on top, followed by Native males, followed by Black females, in that order for 3 straight years. So this data was something that All Hands Raised, the Eliminating Disparities Collaborative, produced. And what they looked at is the number of discipline incidents for what's called disruptive behavior per 100 students. And disruptive behavior, how that's defined, is things like violation of school rules, insubordination, disorderly conduct. You might say that those are sort of more subjective offenses. They tend to be more up to the interpretation of an adult. So that's what is meant in this case. That's what they included in disruptive behavior. And so this is a slide that compares PPS to other districts in Multnomah County. And so there's a couple of interesting items to note in here. One is that you're going to see quite a spike in exclusionary incidents when you get to middle school, and that follows national trends. You're also going to see that PPS is not alone in this challenge, that there are other districts in Multnomah County who are experiencing similar challenges. PPS is sort of excluding students at similar rates in middle school, a little lower in high school, a little higher in elementary for this type of offense.
Park Rose has 0 in elementary schools.
Yeah, that was the data that was provided to us, and we need to kind of go back and look at that. So
it'd be interesting to know if they have a policy about discipline in elementary schools.
Yes.
Because that's, to me, an encouraging stat right there to have 0.
The other thing we know is that disproportionate exclusion by race is present for our 4 to 8-year-old student population. So this begins at pre-K through third grade. And we know that we see that disproportionate discipline beginning very young, with our black students experiencing 5% of them experiencing an exclusionary incident in comparison to 2% of our white students. We have a similar pattern with our Native students at this age. So just to summarize, exclusionary incidents have been decreasing at PPS since 2007. Black students followed by Native students experienced the greatest percentage of exclusionary incidents. African American and Native males are excluded at the highest rates in particular. Exclusionary incidents have been decreasing for Black students since 2007. However, the relative rate of exclusionary incidents between African American and white students has not improved over time. And we know this disproportionate exclusionary discipline begins at a very young age. And so Lenzo eventually is going to talk about some of our supports that we have in place and some of our strategies to address this issue. But one thing we're also focusing on, quite simply, is just the notion of accountability. And so we have set system-wide reduction targets, as Superintendent Smith alluded to, very aggressive ones. And every school also has targets. So we specifically are looking at measuring incidents and students excluded, and we are seeking to cut that in half. And then the other thing to note is, because the goal is both to reduce exclusion by 50%, but also to reduce the disparity or that disproportionality by 50%, what that really means is that we have to improve with our historically underserved populations at a more aggressive or faster rate. And so you're really looking at having our historically underserved populations reduced by 60%. And as I said, every school has a target that's aligned to the system-wide target. And the supervisors of those schools meet monthly with school principals to review their progress on that target, as well as the other priorities that the superintendent had laid out previously. And with that, I'm going to hand it over to Lorenzo, who's going to talk about some of our key strategies.
Before you do that, could you give some specific examples of the kinds of behaviors that kids get excluded for?
Yeah. So it could be, I mean, there's a large range. Disturbingly, for our 4 to 8-year-old population, the number one offense is battery. And it's a weird term for a 4-year-old. But that's an example of something. Violation of school rules could be you're not wearing, you know, your clothing correctly. Maybe you're wearing a hat backwards. I mean, sometimes those can be a violation.
Excluded for wearing their hats backwards?
Well, it would be over a progression of time. I mean, it would be a number of incidents. For some of these detailed questions, I'd actually refer you to some of our program people.
And again, you're looking at incidences where you're having fights in school.
Fights,
or you have some violence between students. You have altercations between staff and students. Those kind of become the kinds of things kids are getting excluded for. So it runs the gamut. It is nothing that is singular. But as we start to look at what they are, when they occur, we're able to strategize for that and begin to address that. So clearly a lot of issues of fighting between students, what we would call insubordination to staff, those kind of things build up over time. Kid is sent out of school. So those become the kind of things kids are excluded for. And of course, when you have weapons or guns brought into a school, that is mandatory reason for exclusion. So you do see those things.
Do you have that data summarized somewhere?
Yes.
And could you send us a link to this report? Because I didn't have anything coming into this, but I think all that data is really useful. I assume it's on your website.
Yes, we have that data. We don't have this presentation on our website, but we can get it up there.
Thank you. Yep. Once it's up, if you can send me the link, I'll post it on my front page.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Lorenzo, please.
Well, let me start by thanking you, Mr. Mayor, for having us here. One of the things that I really appreciate this morning is the framework and context that you set for the reason that we're here. Clearly, we agree that this issue of student achievement, disparities, and particularly disparities in students of color, isn't one that is just a district issue. It really requires support, collaboration, and participation of our communities, jurisdictions, and others, because, again, the consequences of what happens is seen and shows up a variety of systems, a variety of places. So let me thank you and the council for having us here. I want to reiterate that part of what we look at for this disparities, the exclusionary piece, is a 50% reduction overall. A 50% reduction in discipline, an exclusionary discipline, and for us, as we look at the disparities in discipline, it really is vested in what is happening to African Americans and what is happening to Native Americans youth. But we understand it from a strategic standpoint, and what best practices tells us is that you really have to build an environment and a culture in a school that is inclusive, that is supportive, and that is restorative. We look at best practices across the country, positive behavioral support intervention. which is a framework that really talks to students about how do you, in fact, engage every student, family, and staff in understanding the rules and regulations. Some things that sound kind of routine, that kids understand what is expected of them, is not always the case. We have to make sure students understand what is expected of them, and they need to understand, and staff needs to understand, what is expected of them and what is that environment like. So PBIS gives us that framework. We also build into that framework of this notion of restorativeness, because what happens in the process of exclusion, particularly for kids of color, is a violation and severing of a relationship. We are here to build relationships with students. So what happens when those relationships are impaired? We need to find a way to restore that, to build an environment and a climate in a school where it really is about restoring, repairing, and bringing students back into the classroom, because we can't get students to graduation if we're not in school. And making sure that we understand that this really is about restoring, building in that restoration opportunity for staff, student, and community to really be a part of a process that says this is important, you're in class, and we recognize things happen, but how do we then give back in a way that restores and it becomes a meaningful lesson for young people and staff? We're including our community in that because it's important that our community, that all our partners who are in the building and parents who come into the building understand that it is a culture and it will be what Portland Public needs to be in order to build a kind of climate where you don't see the kind of disparities based upon some of the things that we know that we can begin to address and to restore. But we also understand, at least for Portland, as we look at this issue, that the issue historically has been ingrained in an issue around race and culture. You have a tremendous disparity between African Americans and Native Americans. So if you understand it, then how do you really begin to address the issue of race and ethnicity? And from a cultural dynamics, how is that impacting the system? We've been involved in courageous conversations on race for a number of years, and part of that, we have a collaborative action research for equity process, where really is where you foundationally get at how you look and talk about practices and what's going on in the classroom. How the peer-to-peer teachers begin to look at practice and data about what is occurring with them and their students as a way to begin to address and understand from a cultural standpoint what are the kind of nuanced differences we, in fact, need to be doing in our schools in order to address this disparity. Interesting note, we were in Wisconsin with the Council of Great City Schools and we were having these conversations. All districts had talked about the issue of PBIS. They talked about restorative justice. Just Sunday in Oregonian, there was an article about restorative justice as a practice and really building those kind of practice to restore and maintain relationships in the school. But as we looked at everybody's data, this issue of race continued to crop up, and the conversation becomes, if you do not understand from a cultural standpoint, if you do not understand the cultural nuances, you can't begin to address it just with just good programs. So for us, we've aligned and integrated the three concepts to make sure that in the school climate, we're addressing the framework that talks to kids about what is expected in a restorative way, with a recognition that race and ethnicity and culture manifest itself in different ways. And so for us to understand that and work from us is a central piece of what we do. We're also providing for our staffs the courageous conversation on race training for every staff member. I began to look at and address your racial consciousness and understanding how it manifests itself potentially in the work that we do. Also, the revision of our student discipline and conduct document. We need to have the framework of the documentations that, in fact, is the governing piece that students and staff begin to understand their expectations in a way that really addresses the concept of restoration. We want to be a restorative district. It really talks about maintaining, building, and continuing relationships. And when there is some disruption in that relationship, how do you restore that? Because we are a district that paramount is student achievement and making sure the students achieve. The other piece, which is part of Commissioner Friend's asking about the data, is really refining and improving our data ability. We want to have the capability to understand where are the incidents occurring in the during the day in the school. How do we collect the data? How is it real-time data that staff and administrators can begin to use so that you can begin to structurally and strategically align what you do to support and intervene so that you're not in the position of excluding children for the kind of behaviors that we don't want to happen. We're also partnering with families to develop the school climate. We know, and every document and every research says, that you cannot begin to really truly address what is happening in schools and our communities without families' involvement. How do you bring families in? How do you do it in a culturally responsive way? And how do you bring communities to the table so that they're a part of the participation of the plan that addresses their students' discipline, their students' behavior, and the expectations of both parties? So you really have to make sure that you're building that in. In particular communities, we have the challenge of making sure that we're getting parents to the table and participating, because we all know how critical that is. So we're partnering with our community partners and other entities to help make that transition available to us and interacting with a broader community to make that happen. And we want to support students at the earliest signs of concern. As you see from the data, one suspension from the data ends up demonstrating that you have a 43% chance of graduation. And the earlier it is occurring, the less likely it is that now you have a child, a three-year-old being suspended, who's already starting off their journey with an expectation statistically that only 43% of them will graduate. That is not acceptable. So how do we intervene in that early? What are the processes? What are the steps? How do we ensure that teachers have the kind of tools that says that if I am having a disruption in the classroom, what are the kinds of places where they can go and begin to get tutorials, be supported, and ensuring that what we do is restore that relationship and get them back into the classroom as quickly as possible. And because we were making sure that a restorative climate in a school is shared by everybody in the building, in the district, we have a number of outstanding partners. We have the SUN system, which is a part of our schools. We want to train and maintain all the people in the building who interact in our schools around restorative practice and restorative justice so that you have the entire community of a school grounded in restorative practice and climate and what those key strategies are. Lastly, the other piece that we have to continue to focus in on are racial equity and education policy focuses on looking at the chronic achievement gap for black, brown, and red students. That is what we're seeing in the disparities data. But we have to also understand that it's important to note, because often this gets lost in any of our discussions. Since 2007, exclusionary discipline has gone down in the district, including for kids of color, just not as rapidly for our black and red students. So we have to find a way to begin to build upon those things that we know are working and accelerate from a cultural place the closure of that gap. And we believe that looking at that, isolating that, and being very focused, very specific about strategies for African-American males, Native American males, is the approach that it takes to do. Part of it for us, we're going to employ three student assistant coordinators who become the bridge between schools, families, community, students, who are able to, in fact, work with, understand the culture. We have identified a student assistant coordinator who will focus on a caseload of African Americans. We're not saying exclusively that it will only be African Americans, but their focus will be an African American population and understanding the cultural nuances that it brings. One will be to look at and address the issues of a caseload of Native American students, excuse me. And the third will carry a general population, because again, our strategies and concepts have to cover the entire district as we're going to reduce discipline by 50% for the district. But we're also, more importantly, talking about from a cultural standpoint, how, in fact, are we bringing people into our building? We talk about African-American students in recognition that in our schools, you have African-American young men who go through their entire school career without ever having an African-American male teacher, who have go through their entire experience without ever really having a meaningful relationship with an African-American male in the building. How can we bring African-American males into a building to support students and teachers and families? We're contracting with an organization to help us begin to bring African-American males into the building, be seen as a present, to help mediate, be a place where, in fact, when students, particularly males, have challenging issues, then they see no one that looks like them to talk to, We want to make that available because we know what happens when we do that. And we've asked a number of organizations to be a part of that because recruiting and maintaining the level of volunteers that help us make that happen, as we believe, is an outstanding opportunity for our community to come to work with us. We also recognize students who, in fact, often have challenging, traumatic issues in school that manifest themselves in exclusion, have tremendous leadership potential. How do we take that? How do we begin to work with those kids around leadership and begin to turn around and stimulate them in a very cultural way? So we're looking at organizations and contracts that can, in fact, come in and begin to talk about what it takes to lead, what it takes and understand why it's important to be in school, why it's important that when you have challenging issues, you don't act out in the classroom, you deal with that other places. So we're looking at very specific organizations who have a history of working with our populations that we've identified. We also recognize that what happens in exclusion and what happens in school oftentimes is the break in the relationship, and there's a lot of healing that needs to occur within communities. Because when you suspend or expel a student, it has traumatic impact on not just the student, but the family. So we look at the healing circles, which we've been doing in a number of places across the district, but we want to increase the ability to have healing circles with our school community and our parents and community to really address the issue about healing and make a school a place that is belongs to the entire community. And the last one I'll mention is the issue around mental health. So much of what is talked about in our schools is a need to get mental health services to our students. But I do understand that from a cultural standpoint, particularly, and I'll say for African Americans, when you raise the issue of mental health, you have already set up a block for them that making them think that this is about, am I crazy? No. That when you put that block up, because the concept of mental health isn't universally accepted, we want to engage with those mental health professionals who does not come at it in the traditional way. And when I say traditional, it's not just calling it mental health. We can call it counseling. But what you're getting at is the opportunity to build a foundational relationship and then to begin to do the kind of assessments that needs to happen from a mental health standpoint to get children and families the kind of service if they're needed and necessary. So that's the short overview of what our strategies are. We're prepared to take questions we have with us. Those experts who actually do the work are here that can answer any questions in the level of specificity you may need.
Thank you very much. Questions, council members?
Questions. Thanks for your excellent presentation. Couple of observations with the question attached. When I was principal for almost a day recently, I was at Woodlawn. And Woodlawn is about 50% African-American, 50% Latino. And so first question is, does the data around disparities, is it different in schools that are majority-minority versus a school like Ainsworth where the white population is so much larger? Do you see differences based on the demographics of the school that you're looking at? Or are you still looking at aggregate data?
You know, honestly, it depends on the school, because we have 87 schools. And I think honestly, regardless of the school, you do see patterns of our black and our historically underserved students being excluded at higher rates. Okay. In general, there are sort of these outlier schools that are really doing a fantastic job and have closed those. We've identified some of those schools. But again, it's as a general rule, we see exclusion.
So that leads to the second question, Carol, which is what I learned in Woodlawn is that lots of kids are not coming to school ready to learn. And so there's a big focus on the non-cognitive side of the equation. And that's because they're coming from households where there's enough stress, or living in areas where there's enough stress, that the kids are not physically—they're not coming to school in the right disposition, mm-hmm. And so this focus on non-cognitive skills, is that part of your approach to help kids be prepared to learn and addressing some of the challenges they bring into the classroom from their home and their neighborhood?
It's both part of our focus, and it's also part of our focus with partners in terms of meeting us where we need to be met. But like we're focused on building an attendance support. So in some of our clusters, we've started to pilot having people whose sole focus is supporting attendance. We've got more focus on trying to do, we added counseling support last year in all of our schools, and that will be a focus in our budget again this year, is having adults in the building who are able to focus on counseling. We've had conversations with the ESD about increasing nursing support and looking at just the impact that can have in terms of dealing with the other issues kids come to school with.
And we also rely on our community network of support from our Sun Systems and others who and really can begin to engage in, with students in ways that we can as an institution, being prepared to go to the home, helping kids understand and get access to those kind of things for a family that can stabilize them and help kids come to school ready to learn.
And the last thing I would just say on that is from a staffing standpoint in terms of resource allocation, we have an equity allocation, so schools can use that equity allocation as they see fit to meet the unique needs of their school. And on top of that, we have another set of resources for schools that are considered what we call focused and priority schools. And so these schools are the schools who are kind of lower achieving according to the state standards. And in that allocation, we specifically call out a menu of supports that schools can select from. And that includes like social service workers and that sort of thing.
The other thing I'll just share with you is I once spent a day with Tamela Newsom, and I'll never forget one experience, and that was where I was in her office, and a young boy, was referred to her office for a significant disciplinary violation. And this young man had all kinds of issues, and it was very clear even for me, just observing. And she chose not to send him home, and he was abusive towards her. And so I kind of closed the door with her and said, you know, maybe I'm just old school, but, you know, when I was that age, the boom would be lowered. You know, why are you going the extra mile? And she said, well, you have to understand what it means to exclude this child who was maybe, what, second or third grade or something. Mm-hmm. She said that there are sometimes two people at home. One is in the sex trade, and the other one is an abusive male. And she said, I have to balance putting that young person back in an unsafe environment versus maybe doing an in-school exclusion and having him sit in the conference area and keeping my eye on him. But I have to consider the impact on him of sending him back to an unsafe place. That was just mind-boggling. And I think that was, for me, kind of eye-opening about this whole issue of exclusions and how you balance the need for discipline and accountability with the particular custody needs of a individual child. But it's tough enough to be a young person in our society to have that additional burden, mm-hmm. And to not be able to go home to a safe place is just unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And it places unbelievable burdens on administrators and teachers. So it was very eye-opening to hear that, to witness that exchange.
Yeah, thank you for calling that out. The other thing I'd like to just put attention on here is this is part of the value of our partnerships with culturally specific service organizations as well, who may have a whole set of services that also that the family is taking advantage of and have relationships with the family that go over time. So they're not just about a school year. They may be relationships that start when the student is in second grade and go, you know, and the whole family is involved. So us being in partnership with one of those organizations that's involved with the family totally expands our ability to really address the needs that are going on in a home or with a student. And we have numbers of those, and we have worked to really deepen those relationships. And some of our schools have, and again, vary school to school, but Latino Network, ERCO, SEI, NEA, all totally expand our capacity to really meet the needs of a whole child and a family.
But you addressed something, Nick, that really points to us why it is important for us to keep our kids in school, mm-hmm. engaged in school, because not only would the student likely be going home to an environment that isn't good, it's most more likely they're not even going to go home. They end up in the street. Mm-hmm. And that's where you begin to develop the prison pipeline, because a child who's out in the street, no school to go to, often gets involved in things that are less than desirable, and they end up getting into activities that end up manifesting themselves in other systems that other people have to be responsible for. So really for us to figure out and maintain and develop the kind of intellect and strategies to keep our kids in school and engaged is the one that we have to be focused on.
Other questions?
Who makes the decision to
expel or suspend a student?
The principal makes the decision to make the suspension. And again, as Sarah talked about, there are these goals by which we're asking principals to pay attention to, also to begin to involve the senior director in some of those critical decisions. The senior director is ultimately the principal's supervisor. If you're talking about expulsion, that is to be reviewed by the senior director and up to the ladder to looking between the assistant superintendent for schools.
School
performance, and the chief equity officer's office, and we review those kind of issues. But it is generally the principal with guidance, support, oversight from the senior director and the assistant superintendent.
Which is actually, that's actually been a change. So that's a change in our policy. In previous years, it was just the principal, and now we have more stringent guidelines around that.
Other questions, comments?
What are the policies and or strategies you've used to reduce the exclusion rates as much as you have in the past several years?
A lot of reliance on PBIS, our positive behavioral support intervention, has been a process that we've undergone for the last few years, building that climate and culture. Restorative justice. We have a number of restorative justice coordinators in our schools that are helping in suspension and expulsion. A number of student assistant coordinators really to begin to intervene. And CARE is when you're really working with teachers around their practice and looking and examining what it is that they're doing. Often teachers don't recognize what they're doing, and they don't recognize there are other strategies and options. So beginning to develop those things, which is why when we looked at the MAYU of what we've been doing to begin to see it, we've incorporated and expanded on a number of those and included things that were very culturally focused and specific.
So first, thank you, Mayor, for bringing this report. And I request that we have a similar one from Park Rose and from David Douglas, because I think this is very important work. And thank you all for coming to present and for doing the work. I'm wondering about the restorative justice program. Do you contract with Resolutions Northwest for that?
Yes.
And is it in all schools?
No. We've done a couple of things. We do contract with Resolution Northwest even as we're expanding. We're also going to bring on board a restorative justice coordinator whose job will be to help train our folks. And we're also looking at expanding it as we go forward. But again, the theory is really looking at where we need to make the immediate impacts, make sure we get restorative justice coordinators and are the practices in place and expanding it out.
Right. And I certainly support the training of everybody on what the concepts are. I think also there is many advantages to having an outside agency helping with that rather than somebody in the school.
Yeah.
Over the 17 years that I was a Portland Public School parent, we cut every year, and it was I, as a parent, was clamoring for more classroom teachers. When I first attended Kindergarten Roundup back in 1985, was given the card of the elementary school counselor. I think by the time we got out in 2008, there was one counselor per 400 in high school. What's the current staffing of just your regular routine counselors who might be able to intervene before things get to the expulsion set?
So as of this budget, so I'm going to tell you this is the first year since I've been superintendent, and I'm heading into my eighth year that we haven't cut, and we actually added capacity. So our counselor ratio at the high school level is 1 to 300 now, which is significant. And then we also added counseling capacity to every school. So some schools may only have a half counselor, but they have a half, and they previously had none. So, like, as of this year, every one of our schools has counseling presence, and it will be, again, something we look at as we're going into this budget cycle of whether we can add more capacity there. It makes a huge difference.
It does.
It makes a huge difference.
And it's the kind of thing that as a parent, until you need it, you don't realize that it's important. But it certainly is important.
It makes a
huge
difference.
It can help with that whole development of the school culture to have the counseling staff. So if you need me to come and talk to PTAs about what I learned over the course of my time as a parent, I'd be happy to do that. Have you made any specific policy changes or stated expectations for teachers and principals that explicitly set out your expectations on discipline?
So we've just actually done one round of revision to our discipline handbook, which is a conversation between the district and the union. So the part of it's a collaborative conversation about what those changes are, and I anticipate that we'll, and some of that was just bringing us into compliance, but it's also decriminalizing language in terms of how we talk about discipline, and I anticipate more revisions in the years to come. So that'll be part of the project that we're still engaged in.
I was thinking of something like we're not going to exclude kids in elementary school.
So one of the things we're looking at with the Portland Parent Union is the concept of a moratorium. That is something that they're involved in, a national movement to do moratoriums. They've been working with us on figuring out what is a moratorium that could make sense, such as, do you say at the pre-K 2 that you will not exclude? Do you pick subjective offenses like insubordination, as Lorenzo was referencing, where you say we won't exclude based on subjective a subjective events? We haven't actually identified which one it'll be, but as part of our ability to meet the targets that we've said we'll engage in figuring out where's a place that we realistically believe a moratorium would be an effective, stake in the ground.
Yeah, I think setting parameters like that and making it very clear.
We've been looking at our data down to the classroom level, each individual school, individual offenses, individual classrooms, and really trying to make sense of, okay, where would a strategy like a moratorium make sense for us that would really be a lever that helps. So,
and you mentioned the compliance with the state law that requires that non-expulsion, all non-expulsion opportunities should be explored before expulsion is done. How are we complying with that?
That again is a part of the menu of options and strategies we have for schools to, in fact, exercise prior to moving to levels of exclusion or expulsion. And that is part of the conversation and expectations that our senior directors are handing down to principals and having those discussions and in schools so that they know what's available to them and what's required before you move to that level of discipline.
And I would assume that after a student is expelled, that student is still the community's responsibility to educate, right? Mm-hmm. Are you then required to find them alternative placement at an alternative school?
Yeah.
We do. We work with them to find an alternative placement, MESD or alternative school, yeah. Yes.
And is there a time frame that you're required by state law to find them another placement or to offer them another placement? Or a policy that you have?
Hang on, I'm going to let Rick Kirschman come up. He's
Good morning, Council. I'm Rick Kirschman, Program Director for School Climate and Discipline. And generally, yeah, our policy is to reconnect students to what we would call a CBO or a charter-based organization within a timely fashion. So we have a department that focuses on that. So it's part of the expulsion process as kids are connected to another school as soon as possible.
Something that maybe you're looking at already, but I would encourage you to, is instead of having a category of expulsion, which then is like being on a criminal record and is going to follow the kid and is a label for the kid, is to have a transfer policy. I mean, if there has been an incident such as a student bringing a weapon into school, then that's probably not going to be a good placement for that student, regardless of the discipline. But if you were to have a transfer policy or some kind of a mandatory transfer where you find them an alternative placement and do the counseling and immediately get them into another alternative situation, it seems to me that that would be a better way to avoid them dropping out and to be more careful about how the incident that the child made a mistake is handled so that that mistake does not then follow them and direct them into the criminal justice system.
Thank you. That's good.
Good point. Thank you. Any other questions for the team? Thank you very much for being here today. We'll see if there's any citizens that want to comment on this report before we accept it. The primary goal here was just for the council to hear this and have this great discussion. So thank you very much
thank
for
you.
Being here. Anyone want to speak on this item?
We have two people, Joe Walsh and Tanya March.
Okay, come on up, please. Okay, Mr. Walsh, you're on first.
My name is Joe Walsh, and I'm just speaking for myself today. It would be really easy to embrace this entire concept and presentation that you just received, because if you look at it, it sounds really good. Mentoring and equity for the employees, and we have to get figure out a way of using softer language like exclusion instead of expulsion. Expulsion is a very powerful word. Exclusion is kind of like, you know, come back later. I listened very carefully to this, and I was struck by something that happened to me 40 years ago. I was sitting in a political science class in college and heard the same things. And all of you are college graduates. And you heard the same things. You've heard about mentoring. You heard about equity. It might not have been the key word. We didn't use the word pardoning. That's the new word. Everybody wants a pardon with somebody. All I'm saying to you is this is process. When it gets down to the students, you need to ask the questions like Commissioner Fritz asked, how many students to a counselor. You know how important that is? If you have 300 students to a counselor, how long does it take to get to see a counselor? If you have 40 students in a classroom and none of you ask that question, how many kids are in the classrooms? I think it's in the 30s, high 30s, if I'm right. That's important. And the superintendent just got a 23% raise. And I'm saying, this individually, not as representing any organization, that the three people that gave you this presentation are failures. If you looked at those stats, 12% in the black community that are getting expulsion, what percentage of the black community is in our schools? I know it's 6% in Portland. I don't know the percentage in the schools, but I would guess it's small. So that's an astronomical figure. 12% doesn't sound so bad unless you take into consideration the small population of the African American community. And nobody asked that question. Why not? Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Tanya March. I was here in City Hall today because my business partner, Mike Ryerson, passed away in the obit in the Oregonian was only 6 words long. So people here in the community saw me and asked me if I could come up and speak on this issue because they know that I have personal experience. I'm afraid that Nick Fish's comments reinforce stereotypes about parents with children that have faced disciplinary practices within the school district. I think many of you have known me and know my expertise. You may not know the story of myself. I am a mother with two children with special ed, their IEP. I'm on SPIAC, which is a Portland Public School Board where parents with kids with IEPs have representation. Last week, SPIAC members have been told to come to the board meeting to testify. When I got there to testify, we were told that there was no places to testify. So part of this is just going to be me talking from that place that I had wanted to testify last week. I am worried about tokenism, reinforcing stereotypes, and typecasting at parents. My eldest son was sent home from kindergarten, he's now in seventh grade, 30 times. There was no record of this, and I did not realize that there was no record of this until the behavior of him being sent home again repeated in third grade. In kindergarten, I lost my full-time job because I cannot maintain a job when I have no certainty that I'm going to have a place for my child to be. There was not reports of this behavior, and we're talking about children. We're talking autism behaviors. The large size classrooms, the neighborhood school would not even allow my child to enroll, which is why he ended up at an alternative school. You've met him. He is a bright young man. I am supporting my children. My second child, when I found out that he was diagnosed with autism, he is now a second grader, I really decided to focus on my children and my experience. And my experience is when we advocate for our children are punished, and we as parents are punished for our advocacy. And it harms, and it makes a culture that you can't get to resolution. We can't solve problems. And I talk to other parents with children, and we talk, and I sometimes wonder if Portland Public School doesn't realize that parents actually talk together, and we share these stories, and it's heartbreaking when I talk to people that testified last night at the school board meeting that tried to testify the week before, and I find out that the cameras were turned off last night during the school board meeting, and that a public comment was not accepted into the record. And that's like saying, well, you don't want to hear from us, and that hurts. And that's all I had to say.
Thank you.
And I'm sorry for the loss of your partner, and thank you for coming to tell of your personal experience. That takes
and
a lot of courage.
It wasn't, this wasn't planned.
Well, thank you. Coming to the microphone to tell of your experience.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Johnson.
Good morning. Again, for the record, my name is Charles Johnson, and I'm very glad that this report got delivered and that's being taken seriously. However, I think that we need to amp up the seriousness of this. I think that what the citizens really want to see is next week, we want to see the letters that the mayor or the city council has sent to the Paul Allen Family Foundation and to Mr. Phil Knight. The school district is going to need more resources than they think to fix this problem. In the state of Oregon, we have a small black population. A very small fraction of that population gets extremely rich from being trailblazers, and they want to engage with the community and give back. But I think that the success of this program is going to require that all five of you, and then tomorrow, the five county commissioners, engage with the people who have resources and connections. If you engage with professional athletes who are people of color, they've successfully completed school. They've gone actually on to college. And however, we don't want to set forth a situation where athletics is the track of success. We need to find you and the woman who got the $20,000 or $30,000 raise for leading the school district need to find African-American men who are working in science, technology, education, math, STEM workers. There needs to be greater engagement and specific funding targets and time targets, which weren't part of this report. So I look forward to hearing from you how you're going to work with Lou Frederick and Loretta Smith and how we're going to get men from the Trailblazers and players of color from the Portland Timbers and find mentoring relationships for these men and actually do something other than have a report that kind of perpetuates what some people would say, like Joe Walsh indicated, is bureaucraties. So when we have this report, and you may have some of those intentions to cover some of those things I've already mentioned, but they didn't get put in the record, and they need to be verbalized. I'm a little bit disappointed that other groups that work with helping prevent crises, particularly in communities of color in our neighborhood, weren't included by the school district. When we have these situations that raise huge red flags about how our regular white patriarchy is traumatizing, particularly people who are African American or immigrant African or Native American, we need to have people here from the Grand Ron tribe, from the Urban League, the newly elected president of the local NAACP, Joanne Hardesty, is mostly focused on police protection, but one of the ways to reduce police encounters is to help build school success. So I hope that this report is the beginning of some additional hard work for you as you work particularly with leaders who aren't white, and we diversify the face of Portland that's working on these problems. Thank you, commissioners.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Lightning. I represent Lightning PDX Rethink Lab. One of the things I want to emphasize, I do like the report and the speakers, but one of the things I want to emphasize is I want to make sure that Multnomah County Health Department will be involved in this whole situation. When we're talking counselors, when we're talking possibly mental health, behavioral issues, we need to have Multnomah County brought to the table on these issues. They are the trained professionals. We need to have their input on this. Another issue I have on this is that when we're talking, do we have committees set up within these schools that before that individual is, say, excluded for a long term, do we have committees, say, from the neighborhoods, parents, that can actually have a say on that happening?